company will arise at an indicated occasion. He will go and he will open the front door to allow Elijah to enter. Now, why do we continue this outmoded piety? Certainly few of any of us believe in an actual Messiah, and consequently few of any of us believe that he will be announced and forespoken by an ambassador, Elijah. In part, we continue this custom as a statement of open hospitality. No one of our faith should be without a Seder, Passover night. Ho, everyone that is hungry, come ye and eat, and everyone that is thirsty, come ye and drink. That we be far from our home, but without the wherewithal to make the Seder feast. We know that Passover, we can count on the hospitality of our fellow Jews. And in part, and perhaps in largest part, we continue this custom because we also hug to ourselves the ancestral hope of our people. This hope was once personified in the Messiah. We have chosen to extend that image to a messianic age, a time when world order and broad opportunity will be established soundly in our world, and the ancient scriptural promise will come true, for every man will sit under his vine and under his fig tree, none there shall be to make him afraid. Now, the identification of Elijah as a major part of this messianic pageantry is an ancient one. It is first made in our Bible. We read in the prophet Malachi, who, by the way, was the last of the great historical prophets of Israel, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and terrible day of the Lord." Now, I do not cite this messianic history as part of a sermon or essay in messianism, but rather because Elijah's purpose here on earth among us is a striking one and an unexpected one. Malachi says this, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and terrible day of the Lord, and he shall turn the hearts of the children to the parents, and he shall turn the hearts of the parents to their children." If we had paused to think about it, surely we would have conceived the task of a Messiah to be a far more glamorous one. His vocation would be to discuss and to effect treaties among the powerful and in the chanceries of the world. Instead, his purpose, his original priority, is intimate and personal and familial. His work is our own, to establish wholeness and wholesomeness in our homes. It is as if Malachi were saying to us, before you set out to set your world in a better order, make sure that your own house is in order. It's a fine thing and a brave thing to man the ramparts of change. It's a fine and a brave thing to sit down with committees of sober purpose. It's a fine and a brave thing to speak to enthusiastic audiences of revolutionaries. It's a fine and a brave thing to politic and to pressure and to petition. But first and foremost, build your home in soundness. Establish your home in purpose. The best conceived plans for social change, the most visionary programs for improvement, fall if we lack sturdy citizens, if we lack people of quality who can put them into effect. And where is sturdiness and morality and faith and courage built? In the home. The home, in a sense, sculpts personality. We wish to establish our world in greater opportunity. Turn to the home. You know, I'm often asked, Rabbi, realistically, what can I do? I want peace. I want broader understanding between men. I would like to see a greater justice in our world. But what can I do besides reading the grim headlines and occasionally casting one vote among 70 million, and occasionally writing a letter to some congressperson which will probably be counted rather than read? What can I do? Have I no other alternative but to be busy with my routines and to pray, to hope for the better? Are all the decisions out of my hands? Not so. The fate of the world is determined in the kitchens and in the libraries and in the living quarters of our homes. Politics is a strange thing. Overnight, wartime enemies become peacetime allies, and peacetime allies become wartime enemies. Politics can be changed, and changed rapidly. But a world which lacks a sturdy citizenry, a world which lacks sensitive, kindly, committed people, a world of the emotionally crippled and hobbled, such a world cannot establish peace. Such a world cannot bring about a greater opportunity. And if you would be anxious for our world, draw not your anxiety from the scare headlines and the grim and foreboding news, but draw it from the statistics which are being writ large for us of the breakdown and the disorganization and of the disorientation of homes the world over. This is the crucial problem which confronts us. For if history has any one truth, it is this. When the home, the family, the central building block of civilization breaks apart, when the family loses its relationship with the ongoing dynamic of society, that society begins to fall apart, to break up, to destroy itself. And it's true of us, is it not? It's true of us that we tend to set almost every individual responsibility above our responsibilities to our home. Father and his responsibilities to business. Mother seeking to make for herself a place in the outside world. Children with their friends and their schooling. And I wonder, what will father have gained when he has climbed to the top of the ladder of success and he has no one intimate with him to share the joy of success? And I wonder, what will mother have gained when she is accepted for herself, for her skills and her mind by the broad world without, but she has no acceptance among her children, whose petty silences and petty peeves she had no time for, whose aggravations, scoldings and whinings she thought beneath her? And what of the children? Will they have been given strength, a sense of solidarity, a purpose in such a home? Or will they have been psychologically hobbled? Will they become men and women who can contribute to their society and lead their society? Or will they sap it of its strength, demand of its services, lead selfish lives, ingrown, bitter? The future of our world depends upon the quality of our homes. You and I, though we may not sit in the council seats of the mighty, control the destiny of the world in our own hands. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet. Read ourselves. Before the great and terrible day of the Lord, and he must change the heart of the parents to the children, and the heart of the children to the parents. Now, parenting is not an easy task. It has never been. I sometimes, being an historian, must smile to myself when I hear the bitter jeremiads of parents who believe that it was never so difficult to raise a child as in this affluent and prosperous society of ours. Our grandfathers didn't have to compete with television and didn't have the psychological trauma of a car. Somehow our world is far more difficult than any that was known before. And I had one observe to me that this prophecy of Malachi's really ought to be read not as a statement of the priority of the family, but as the statement of the simple truth that unless some miracle intervenes, the Messiah, you and I will never be able to set our families in order. I doubt it. Parenting is a difficult task, to be sure. But it has always been so. And when men and women were willing to focus and center their energies on the home, this task could be discharged with dignity and with a rare degree of success. For I would remind you that ours is not the first age which has had difficulty in the rearing of children. I don't know if Adam and Eve or if Jacob and Rachel ever went to a school guidance counselor, but they certainly weren't able to cope with a problem of sibling rivalry. And I don't know if Noah or Isaac had read Dr. Spock, but I do know that they were not able to teach their young people respect for the elderly, even in their senility. And you can read in our Talmud the sighing confession and complaint of one first century teacher, Eliezer bar Yehuda, who observes that it is easier to raise a grove of olive trees in the totally unsuitable soil and climate of the Galilee than it is to raise a single upright son or daughter anywhere in Israel. And our Talmud never refers to the joy of child-rearing, but always to the tsar gidul banim, the heartache and the headache of raising children. This being so, the fact that child-rearing requires a rare degree of maturity and of understanding which can be born only of experience and of knowledge leads me to believe that one of the true, the most cruel tragedies of this generation is a precipitous entrance into motherhood by so many of our very young. What can an 18 or 19-year-old girl know of life? How can she establish a pattern, a philosophy of discipline and of learning in her home? She has hardly completed her rebellion against her own parents. If she were in college, she would be sophomoric. And by that we mean she would be vacillating between extremes, one pole and another, as she was trying to carve out some philosophy, some way of life which was her own. But as a mother, she must have a stable and fixed purpose. She must set standards for her home, standards which she cannot yet understand, standards which cannot but be some distorted mirror image of what she knew in her own home. I cannot but believe that the dull image so many of our young girls who think of childbearing as the handling and the fondling and the cuddling of a baby leads them into responsibilities for which they are not prepared. What do they do with the midnight croup? What do they do with the tempered tantrums? What do they do with the cajoling and the whining, the discipline problems? What do they do in making the difficult decisions as to standards of punishment and standards of learning and standards of morality? And I must add this, lest some of you feel exonerated, that I find that these young people, though they wish for an early marriage, often do not wish for early children. But they are still themselves children, more than they know it, under the influence of their own parents. And so many of you are so eager to be grandparents, to dangle your immortality on your knee, that you force these young people into parenthood long before they are prepared for it. In another age, in another clime, when life expectancy was half of what it is today, early motherhood was understandable. But our mothers today will live to a ripe old age, and they can bear children to well into middle age. And surely they ought to be given the opportunity to come alive as human beings, for we force them into a responsibility which they cannot possibly discharge. Parenting has never been an easy task. Most of us are terribly over-concerned about gaining and keeping the friendship of our children, communication with our children, familiarity with them. Ours is the first generation, consequently, which has ever felt guilt about disciplining and punishing a child. Indeed, we are the first generation which has ever tacitly assumed that a child will simply grow. You know the rationalizations. Boys will be boys. You were young once. We all engaged in escapades, all in an attempt to interpose the parent between the child and responsibility. This is a prevailing cultural pattern or prejudice of ours. And if you doubt it, listen and provide the ending to this little poem by Mr. Franklin P. Adams. It's called Those Two Boys. When Bill was a lad, he was terribly bad. He worried his parents a lot. He'd lie and he'd swear and pull little girls' hair. His boyhood was naught but a blot. At play and in school, he would fracture each rule in mischief from autumn to spring. And the villagers knew when to manhood he grew, he would never amount to a thing. When Jim was a child, he was not very wild. He was known as a good little boy. He was honest and bright, and the teacher's delight, and to his mother and father a joy. All the neighbors were sure that his virtue endure, that his life would be free of a spot. They were certain that Jim had a great head on him, and that Jim would amount to a lot. Conclusion. And Jim grew to manhood and honor and fame and bears a good name, while Bill is shut up in a dark prison cell. You never can tell. Now, the great American assumption is that Bill grows up into leadership and Jim somehow falls from grace. But it is not always so. You never can tell. Children require discipline. Children thrive on discipline. A child stumbles all over himself if he is faced with a decision in which he is given neither guidance nor leadership nor knowledge, if the requirements of making that decision are beyond his ability to conceptualize at that moment. Children need responsibility, a sense that they carry the decisions of their own lives. If they make them, they will be praised. If they fail in them, they will be punished. I give you a conversation. The young mother sat in my office pulling at her handkerchief. Rabbi, I don't know, she said. I probably didn't spend enough time with my boy. Perhaps I shouldn't have taken that job with an auxiliary when he was in the kindergarten class. But I thought he was older. Or do you think, Rabbi, that I loved him too much, that we fondled and caressed him over much? Rabbi, I've been so worried. What do you think I should have done? Can you guess the conversation? Her boy was 12 years old. He had been in class in Sunday school, and he had copied an examination from the child next to him. And I had simply indicated the offense to the mother and told her of the punishment which would be imposed upon the child. What was that mother doing? Interposing herself between the child and a responsibility the child could easily bear. She was assuming his guilt, though it was none of her own. And all of us tend to justify and to rationalize, to excuse and to exonerate our children, and even to psychoanalyze ourselves to find deep down in our early treatment of the child the cause of all of his wildness, mulishness, all of his antisocial behavior. This, of course, is an exaggeration of a truth which Dr. Freud found in his study of mentally disturbed mothers, that often their emotional disturbance came from some trauma deep-seated in their childhood. But you cannot extrapolate from this the proposition that a child can never be repressed, that a child can never be disciplined, that you may not say no and mean it. You may not set rules and punish the child if he fails to abide these rules. Indeed, I would put before you the counter proposition, the proposition of our Bible. Train up the child in the way that he shall go, and he will walk therein even when he is in his age. According to the Midrash, when a boy is prepared to begin to learn to read, his father is to teach him the first verse which he is to read from the Bible. And what is that verse? Torah tziva lanu Moshe. Moses commanded us a law. Life is lived within law. Man is free within rules and regulations. And this is certainly true of our adult world. And how can a child be free, a man be free and creative within law and under law, if in his childhood he has not learnt to abide regulation, to live within certain fixed rules, and yet to maintain his integrity and his freedom? Children require discipline. Discipline, of course, need not be tyrannical. The book of Proverbs says, Hoshech shifto sone beno, ve'ohavo shicharo musar. He who withholds physical punishment actually hates his child. He lacks sufficient love for his child to steel himself to his child's tears. And he who loves his child reproves him early and often. Now, don't run home and beat your child. But do set up in your homes a pattern of discipline, which your child understands, through which he can gain approval, by abiding which he can prove to you his love and his growing maturity, and a pattern which allows you to organize a home for the benefit of all who live in it, child and adult. But obviously, you cannot raise a child and train a child through his backside only. Children learn their best lessons through their eyes and through their ears, by watching and listening, by learning how you live. For you are the rabbi and the philosopher and the father confessor and the teacher of morals as well as the parent. At almost every parent-teacher's meeting here at the temple, I am asked, and asked with a sense of urgency, Rabbi, when does the temple teach ethics? Well, we teach ethics from the very beginning. It is implicit all that happens here. But we have your child for 2 hours a week. And what can we teach your child? The fine formulations of our tradition, the Ten Commandments, love thy neighbor as thyself, do not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. Proclaim freedom unto the land. Establish justice in the gates. You know these formulas well. But what are they? Fine, beautiful sayings or principles of life? How does the child determine that? Whether they be dusty axioms, forever dusty, or living truths to be established and woven into life through what he sees in the home. Establish a home in decency. Let the father conduct himself with courage and courtesy. Let the mother manage the home with love and forbearance. Let the conversation at the dinner table be one of sympathy and of understanding for all who are part. Let there be rules which the child understands. Let there be a sense of citizenship in the larger community. Let gossip and backbiting be absent. And the child will understand that which is taught him here. Let the home be established in bitterness and gall. Let the foundations of the home be wormwood. Let the conversation of the home be silent. Let the home be a place of eating and sleeping and occasional meeting and a great deal of yelling. And the child will wonder And the child will come to that inevitable conclusion which is so prevalent in our society today, that the morality of the church tradition, of the religious tradition, belongs in the church or in the temple, that there is another way of life, a hard-nosed, self-seeking, greedy way of life, which is the appropriate way of life outside the confines of this purity. You are the moralists to your children. Not so much in what you say, but in what you do. For there is no virtue in preaching the conventional moralities and practicing the conventional immoralities. You are the teachers. A child learns by mimicking. First he learns to speak by mimicking your speech. Then he walks in the same way that you dress yourself. And finally he learns to mouth the truths which are yours, and perhaps he learns to see the hypocrisy of the truths which you claim to be yours. I shall never forget the opening line of a little essay which a confirmation child submitted to me on the general theme, the problems of a teenager. This was a girl, a 14-year-old girl. Pardon the grammar, it's hers, not mine. She said, the greatest problem for a young person growing up today is learning manners without seeing any. I would add to this my own emendation to the line from Proverbs, which I quoted to you earlier. Train up a child in the way that he shall go, and he will walk therein even in his age. Train up a child in the way that he should go, and walk therein yourself some of the time. Friday night next, we will be at our Seder tables. Seder is a family occasion. In some of our homes, it is one of the few occasions in which the family actually sits down together and talks together. Friday night, we will open the door for Elijah. As we do, recall the priority of Elijah's mission among us. Turn the hearts of the parents to the children and the hearts of the children to the parents. In all probability, Elijah will not be there. That task, consequently, is yours as it is mine, and surely it must be a priority of our lives. Amen.